Welcome to 99. We're a church in San Francisco for the rebels and runaways. We're really glad you're here, and we hope you enjoy this teaching.
So I got to start by just saying, I'm a 90s kid through and through. I grew up on Rugrats, Beanie Babies, Tamagotchis, Pogs, whatever you name it. I'm a straight up 90s kid. And in the 90s, there were these collections of books, these popular set of books called Magic Eye. Do you remember Magic Eye, anyone? Wow, I dated myself. Okay, well, these are Magic Eye books. If you go to the next slide, Toby. Magic Eye books were filled with what's known as stereograms, okay? It just looks like abstract paintings from the MoMA, right? But it's not. They're stereograms, and if you look at it specific ways, there are 2D images, random patterns, that if you look at it the right way, 3D images begin to emerge from it. So you can't do it from where you're sitting, but if you were able to get close and train your mind's eye, you could actually see 3D images embedded in these random 2D abstract images. And so each page would be filled with these 2D images of seemingly random shapes and colors, but if you looked at it the right way, these 2D images would transform into 3D images. All y'all gonna Google this at home after, right? I think for many of us, the Bible is like a magic eye. Right, a bunch of abstract shapes and patterns and colors that don't seem to make much sense to us. But if you learn to see the Bible just right, if you learn to posture yourself and change your perspective, if you have the eyes to see it for what it really is, all of a sudden these ordinary random abstract shapes, colors, patterns, and images come alive in a new way and show us something new. And so when reading the Bible, essentially what we're trying to do is take these two-dimensional words on paper and transform them into a 3D experience encounter with God so that the text takes on new life, new meaning, new depth, and new perspective and gives us life for today. So I think for most of us, when we think about the Old Testament, we kind of approach it, we see it kind of like a magic eye that we can't seem to crack. Right? What's with all the bloodshed? What's with all the weird sacrifice rituals? What's with the hundreds of seemingly random laws? Like, we love the Psalms, but Leviticus, no thank you. What's more, why does God in the New Testament seem so different from God in the Old Testament? In the New Testament, God is so kind. He's so loving. He's so forgiving. He's so patient. But in the Old Testament, why is God so angry all the time? Why is he so jealous and vindictive and violent? And most of us, unable to reconcile these difficult questions, we often gloss over the Old Testament and just spend most of our time in the New Testament. I believe a study was done a few years ago asking followers of Jesus how much time you spend in the Old Testament versus the New Testament. And there was over 50% of believers that never spend any time in the Old Testament and spend most of the time in the New Testament. But of course, Psalms and Proverbs get a pass, right? Now, I don't know if you remember, but in November 2020, as if the pandemic wasn't enough to deal with, we also faced another national tragedy, or I would say, dare say, an emergency. During that time in 2020 in November, Taco Bell discontinued the Mexican pizza. Do you remember this? The world lamented. The outcries were loud and strong. Why? Because Taco Bell isn't Taco Bell without the Mexican pizza. It's like taking the Big Mac away from McDonald's. It's not the same. And in the same way, the story of the Bible is not complete without the Old Testament. We can't take it. We can't remove it. As difficult and as confusing and for many of us as problematic as it is for us to understand, we can't just ignore it or just skip over it. We have to find a way to reckon with it. But when we do, I believe we get a more rich, more complex, more complete picture of the gospel and the beauty of the Christian faith. And so today, I'm going to answer three questions. How do we approach the Old Testament? How do we make sense of it all? And how do we know what to obey and what is okay not to obey, okay? So I'm going to start with this famous satirical letter that was written to radio host Dr. Laura Schlesinger. Dr. Laura is this Jewish author who would offer practical advice about relationships, about parenting, about ethics, about life based all on Old Testament principles. So Dr. Laura is a hardcore fundamentalist conservative. She goes to the Old Testament, follows it to a T, and she gives advice on her radio show based on Old Testament principles. And so there was this famous satirical letter that was written to Dr. Laura, and I'm just going to read it for you. It says this: "Dear Dr. Laura, thank you for doing so much to educate people regarding God's law. I have learned a great deal from your show, and I try to share that knowledge with as many people as I can. I do need some advice from you, however, regarding some of the specific laws and how to follow them. I would like to sell my daughter into slavery as sanctioned in Exodus 21:7. In this day and age, what do you think would be a fair price for her? I have a neighbor who insists on working on the Sabbath. Exodus 35:2 clearly states he should be put to death. Am I morally obligated to kill him myself? A friend of mine feels that even though eating shellfish is an abomination, it is a lesser abomination than homosexuality. I don't agree. Can you settle this? Leviticus 21:20 states that I may not approach the altar of God if I have a defect in my sight. I have to admit that I wear reading glasses. Does my vision have to be 20/20, or is there some wiggle room here? I know from Leviticus 11:6 through 8 that touching the skin of a dead pig makes me unclean, but may I still play football if I wear gloves? I know you have studied these things extensively, so I'm confident you can help. Thank you again for reminding us that God's word is eternal and unchanging." Now, obviously, that was satire. But I think the point is valid. If it's as simple as just reading the Bible and doing what it says, why do people cherry pick what must be obeyed and what's not okay to obey? I think the first thing we have to understand about the Old Testament is that, yes, it is full of wisdom, but not all of it is timeless wisdom. If you remember the definition of the Bible we shared at the beginning of this collection, the Bible is a library of writings that are both divine and human that together tell a unified story which leads us to Jesus. Remember, the Bible is first and foremost a story. It is not a law book. It is not a rule book. There's a Jewish author by the name of A.J. Jacobs who wrote this really funny book titled The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. And so he got all the laws that he found throughout the Bible. He found 72 pages with over 700 rules, and he tried his best to live all of them by all of them for an entire year. And as you can imagine, it was hilarious. For an entire year, he did his best to live by commands like bathe after sex, do not eat the fruit from a tree planted less than 5 years ago, do not wear clothes of mixed fibers, do not shave your beard, and kill magicians, which we should still abide by today. Okay, and so he tried to abide by all of these things, minus killing magicians, of course. He would be in jail. And he found that it was very difficult, right? It's very difficult. It was timeless. It's not timeless wisdom. It was wisdom for another people in another context in another time. The Bible is a story. Therefore, the rules and commands that are right and fitting for one part of the story may not be right and fitting for another part of the story. And so the laws that God gave ancient Israel were laws for ancient Israel and not necessarily for us. If you remember the context, God rescues his people out of slavery and says, "This is the people I want you to be." The laws that he gives his people after the Exodus are to shape the kind of people that he wants them to be. But when we try to live out commands and laws that were designed for a completely different people in a completely different time, in a completely different context, we start looking like a 60-year-old in skinny jeans, right? We start looking like a preacher that says 6'7", right? We look completely outdated because we are trying to follow rules of wisdom for one people that are not appropriate for our time and our place. The problem is that there are so many believers who have an oversimplified approach to the Bible. Just do what it says. But here's the thing. Most people who have a just do what it says attitude are actually just cherry picking which parts of the Bible they choose to obey. So why does just do what it says apply to abstaining from premarital sex, but not to wearing head coverings in the church? Why does just do what it says apply to tithing, but not selling all your possessions and giving it to the poor? That's a good one, huh? You didn't know the Bible commanded that too. There's context we are called to explore, that these rules and commands were right and fitting for one part of our story, but not necessarily for our part. Biblical author Scott McKnight, he says, What we most need is not a return to the 1st or 4th or 16th or 18th century, but a fresh blowing of God's Spirit on our culture, in our day, and in our ways. We need 21st century Christians living out the biblical gospel in 21st century ways. Even more, if we read the Bible properly, we will see that God never asked one generation to step back in time and live the way it had done before. No, God spoke in each generation in that generation's ways. In other words, the biblical authors and the early church fathers, they went back to the Bible so that they could move forward into the present. And I think the greatest need in the church in our day and age is that we need to learn how to go back to the Bible without getting stuck. We need followers of Jesus who are willing to live out 21st century faith. How do we do missions ethically without tainting it with our Western colonial mindset? How do we regulate social media consumption? How do we develop biblical ethics when our world is so progressively changing? That's not to say that all commands in the Old Testament should be ignored or thrown away. You probably shouldn't murder. Right? You probably shouldn't cheat on your spouse. You probably shouldn't bathe a goat in its mother's milk. But this fundamentally changes the way that we approach the Old Testament, doesn't it? Not as a rule book to follow, but as a story to get immersed in. And so instead of following these laws and commands literally that were given for a specific people in a specific time, our goal when reading the Old Testament should be getting familiar with the one who gave these commands. In getting to know who these stories are all about. The first question that we should always ask when reading the Old Testament is not what should we do? How should we respond? How should we live this out? The first question we should always ask when reading the Old Testament is what is God like? And what we discover is that God didn't just give Israel these hundreds of laws because he's some sort of control freak or dictator. God gave these laws because he was trying to show Israel the kind of people he was calling them to be. Now, in our household, we have Zion just turned 5 this past week, Ezra just turned 3 this month, and we're celebrating, right? In our house, we have rules. One of the rules is don't hit the TV, because just the other month, someone hit the TV and there's a big black spot on our TV now that we just bought a year ago, okay? We have rules in our household because we're trying to shape them to be a specific kind of people when they grow up. We teach them to respect their elders. We teach them how to always say thank you and please. All these rules are given in our household to try to shape our sons to be the kind of people that we want them to be. When Israel was coming out of slavery, out of the Exodus, God gave these laws not to try to manipulate or control them. He gave them these laws to try to shape them into a God-like people. And so all of the laws were given in order to shape the kind of people he wanted them to be. God was showing Israel the kind of people that he wanted them to be and the kind of God that he was. But I think we look at books like Leviticus and think, man, some of these laws seem so archaic and strange. But what we actually find, if you go deeper into the laws of Leviticus, for example, God was teaching his people things like generosity to the poor, fair treatment of employees, practical compassion for the disabled, respect for the elderly, integrity of the judicial process, safety precautions to prevent endangering life, ecological sensitivity, quality of life for ethnic minorities, honesty in trade and in business, right? Today we call these things human rights. But back then, God gave these laws in order to try to shape a people that was unique and different from the rest of the world. God gave Israel all these laws so they could look more and more like Yahweh, to be holy and set apart from the other nations. In Matthew 22, 34 through 40, Jesus said, we're honing in on a part of Jesus' story. And this is how he responds to some of the Sadducees and Pharisees. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and this second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself." Now, this is the key part. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. What's Jesus saying? every law that God gave to Israel was to set them up to love God and to love others better. And every command that God gives you and I is given to accomplish these two things as well. And this is a good litmus test for what understanding what we should obey from the Bible, what commands we should take on. The questions are, does it help me love God better? And does it help me love others better? But wait a minute. You might be saying, love your neighbor. That sounds good. That sounds beautiful. That sounds like the God I know and love. But when we look at the Testament, what about slavery? What about the treatment of women? What about genocide? How do we reconcile? How do we make sense of a God who allowed all those things to happen in the Old Testament? That doesn't really line up with loving your neighbor as yourself. And so we're going to go to one such passage. It's going to be a really tough one. Deuteronomy 21, 10 through 14. This is a great text to preach out of, y'all. So we're going to read through it, and we're going to try to understand the context behind it. When you go to war against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands and you take captives, red flag, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife, red flag, bring her into your home and have her shave her head, red flag, trim her nails, red flag, and put aside the clothes she was wearing when captured, red flag, and she has lived in your house and mourned her father and mother for a full month, then you may go to her and be her husband and she shall be your wife, red flag. If you are not pleased with her, let her go wherever she wishes, green flag. You must not sell her or treat her as a slave since you have dishonored her. Now we read this. Right? We read this in our modern day progressive church context. No one reads this and thinks, wow, the Bible is awesome. I'm going to get this passage tattooed on my left bicep. This is the memory verse I'm going to memorize for the week, right? We read this and something inside us, like we feel weird or icky about it, right? And you should, right? This is the problem though. We read and compare this text or text like this to our modern day Western progressive context. But when we approach the Old Testament as a story, our job isn't bringing these stories into our world today. Our job, first and foremost, is entering into their world, into their story. And this is what we find. Their world and their time was barbaric. It was archaic. In that time, the victor of war was allowed to do anything that they wanted to those that they beat in battle. Nothing was off limits. The worst things that you could think of done to humanity, they could do, and it was acceptable and okay in that world. But notice, even in this passage that we just read, how God, he actually restricts the rights of the victorious soldier. Right? God says, you cannot rape those people, first and foremost. He says, you cannot just take women for sexual temporary pleasure. Now, to us in our modern day context, duh, right? Of course you would not do those things. But at this time, you have to understand, something like this was revolutionary. So we read this and we're like, this is hella regressive. But back in the day, something like this was extremely progressive. And God says, he takes it a step further. He says, if you do want to take a woman, which is still a red flag, right? You actually have to take full responsibility for her. You can't just sleep with her and toss her to the side. You have to make her your wife with all the legal and social benefits that belong with it. And he also says, but you can't just do that immediately. You have to give her time and space to mourn and adjust to her suffering. Okay, that's like better, but still red flag, right? Like what? Like how do we make sense of that? Still not great. So God's saying it's okay for a man to take a woman as his wife without their consent. Who cares if he takes care of her? What about her agency, right? But here's the thing that most people miss in this passage. The last line of this passage is actually a criticism of the whole practice in and of itself. It's a condemnation of the whole practice. He says, you must not sell her or treat her as a slave since you have dishonored her. God is putting limits on what they can do, but he's also saying this is not the ideal. Even though you do these things and it's less archaic and barbaric than the rest of the world, this is still not the ideal. You've actually still dishonored her because you've taken her without her consent. You have made her your wife without her consent. In fact, it's far from the ideal. He clearly says by doing this, you have dishonored her. The laws we read in the Old Testament that confuse us are both accommodating for that culture and future looking for that culture. Let me say that again. The laws that we read about in the Old Testament are both accommodating for that culture and both future looking for that culture. God, in other words, was trying to pull Israel forward as a society toward his ideal, but he couldn't do that in a single sweep, which is why we see laws like this, where he's inching Israel forward. Imagine, I was watching a show a few years ago, and I learned for the first time about sundown towns. Have you guys heard about that? In certain cities and towns in the United States during the height of racism in America, there were certain towns where if you were a person of color, if you were black, you could not be in that town when the sun was going down, or people had the right to kill you and murder you and lynch you. Right? Imagine going to Americans at the height of racism and trying to undo racism and slavery in that time. Like, you come as a herald, as a prophet. Imagine trying to move a mostly racist America forward as a country, progressing them out of racism towards equity, right? It couldn't happen overnight. And even to this day, we see that even though there are laws in place to condemn racism, we're still so far off from the ideal. So imagine God is going to these people, this ancient, barbaric, archaic people, and he's trying to inch them toward the ideal. He couldn't do it in a single sweep. So we find that God's laws are both accommodating to that culture, but also forward-looking for that culture. God was trying to inch Israel forward without leaving them behind. And so we find that in the Old Testament, it's a story that reveals a God who is trying to move humanity back toward the ideal, back to Eden, where people can freely love God and freely love others. And this story, it finds its crescendo in the person of Jesus. If we go to Luke 24, 25 through 27, this is after Jesus was arrested and crucified and after he resurrected. And the disciples are walking on a road called Emmaus, and they're grieving the loss of their friend and rabbi and Messiah. And they come across this man that they don't recognize as Jesus, but it is Jesus. And this is where the story picks up. He said to them, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." Now, the funny thing about that is that these disciples that were walking on this road, they knew the scriptures in and out. They knew, like, they grew up on these stories, on these tales. They knew everything about the scriptures, but now they're walking with this random man on this road to Emmaus, and he begins unpacking the scriptures in a fresh way. And finally, when he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" The question is, what caused their hearts to burn? The same scriptures they had known their entire lives, but now they're walking with this random man after the death and loss of their friend and Messiah, and he's unpacking the scriptures, and all of a sudden their hearts begin to burn. It was the same scriptures they had known their entire lives, the same stories, the same laws, the same poems they had read and studied and memorized from childhood. Why was it now that their hearts began to burn? I'll tell you what happened. Their eyes began to open. All of a sudden, the 2D words began transforming before their very eyes into a 3D encounter with God. They began to see that every verse, every poem, every story, every command, everything that they had heard from the scriptures their entire lives, they realized at that moment on the road with Jesus that all of it was pointing to Jesus. One of my favorite movies, have you seen Fight Club? It's a banger back in the day. But if you see the movie and you get to the end, it actually changes the way that you see the rest of the story. You're like, oh my God, there's actually only one of them. I thought there were two of them, but sorry, that was a spoiler alert. But go watch the movie. If you watch it the first time, you get to the end, you got to watch it again. And all of a sudden, it takes on new meaning, right? What happened here on the road to Emmaus, the story, the movie, the scriptures that they had known their entire lives, all of a sudden, Jesus unpacks it in a way where they realize, oh my God, all these things that we knew was actually pointing to Jesus. all of was pointing to this moment. They began to see that everything was pointing to Jesus. And they began to see Jesus in every scene, in every story, in every poem, in every passage they had known growing up. And now they were able to see Scripture through a different lens. Now they were able to see that when the psalmist wrote that poem, they were actually writing about Jesus. Now they were able to see that when God led the people out of Egypt, out of slavery, it was a prophetic foretelling of our exodus out of our slavery to sin. All of a sudden, this ancient text came to life in a new way. And then in Matthew 5:17, to cap this off, Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the laws or the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them." What's he saying? Jesus came as the completion of the story which the Old Testament had told, and as the fulfillment of the promise that the Old Testament had declared. And here's the beautiful thing. Just like knowing New Testament Jesus helps us understand the Old Testament better, knowing the Old Testament actually helps us understand the New Testament better too. Being familiar with the Old Testament helps us to fully grasp the beauty of the New Testament. It helps us to understand the person and the work of Jesus to a greater degree. Old Testament scholar John Golden-Gay says that the New Testament is nothing but footnotes of the Old Testament. And so he argues that one cannot produce a theology just out of footnotes. You can't take the New Testament in isolation and form an entire theology just on that. If you don't have the Old Testament in your head, you can't fully grasp what the New Testament authors are saying. And I make this illustration once every year. In 2019, probably the greatest moment in my life, not the greatest moment, but one of the greatest cinematic moments in my life was watching Avengers Endgame, right? What made it an incredible experience was that I watched all 27 films that came before it, right? Some of us were rushing to, I forgot who I went with, but when we watched Endgame, it was the first Marvel Cinematic Universe movie that they were watching with us. And so they were lost. Like, why is there two Captain Americas? What's going on? Like, they had no idea what was going on, right? The first 27 movies set up the experience of the final movie. When we read the Old Testament, it's like rewatching all 27 of the MCU original films. And the New Testament is like an endgame experience where we encounter the beauty and the fullness and the personhood of Jesus. And so just to show an example of what this could look like, I want you to imagine that we're transported back in the day and we're walking with the Israelites. They had just been delivered out of slavery, out of Egypt, and they're walking on the way to the promised land after passing through the Red Sea. I want you to imagine if you asked that Israelite, just any one of them, and just asked, "Who are you? Like, tell me about your story, about your people. Like, what's going on? What situation are you in?" He might say something like, "You know, I was in a foreign land under the sentence of death, in bondage, enslaved, but I learned to take shelter under the blood of the Lamb, and death passed us over. And now we are rescued out of slavery and we're on our way to the promised land. And even though we're not there yet, our God who rescued us from slavery, he's given us his law to make us into a people, to make us into a community. And he's given us this tabernacle because we have to learn to live by grace and by forgiveness. And he's present in our midst. He is with us until we arrive back at home." Now, you might think, of course, like that's the Old Testament story. But if you look a little deeper, doesn't that also sound just like our lives? Like, we are the ones that Jesus rescued out of slavery. We are the ones that crossed over from death to life. And Jesus is leading us home. He's leading us to the promised land. And though we're not quite there yet, he says, "I am with you on the journey." This is what it's like to see the Old Testament not as a rule book to follow, but as a story to be immersed in that leads us into an encounter with the person of Jesus. Now, in response, my homework for you today, we live in a time where we're trained to look at each part of the Bible in isolation, right? So we pull verses out of context for our Instagram feeds, for our tattoos, for whatever it might be, instead of looking at the whole story in its entirety. But here's the thing. One chapter Bible readers develop one chapter Christian lives, right? And so we have to learn to see beyond the pull-out, cherry-picked one-chapter Bible verse. So this week, I want to invite you to do something that maybe some of you haven't done for a while. I'm inviting you to study. You know, study is actually a Christian discipline and Christian practice. And it's funny because we study all sorts of other things in our lives. We study when we need a new mattress. I don't know why I keep using that example. Some of you might need a new mattress. I don't know. But we study when we need a new car. We study when we need a new computer. We study when we need a new phone. We study so many ways. But when it comes to Scripture, we don't. Richard Foster, he once said, study is a specific kind of experience in which through careful attention to reality, the mind is enabled to move in a certain direction. It's like focusing your mind in a specific direction and untangling the web that comes before. Now, it's shocking to me how many people have formed their theology about sexuality, about women in leadership, about abortion, without having studied what the Bible has to say about it for themselves. Not just what your pastor told you, not just what your church leaders told you, not just what your parents told you, but what you actually studied for yourself. So this week, my invitation, this is not required, but I do encourage you to do it, is to choose a section of the Old Testament that has always confused you, or offended you, like the passage we just read, or something that you want to learn more about. And my challenge to you is to seek out wisdom on the context of the thing that you're reading, seek out commentaries, sermons, books, YouTube videos on the topic, and spend time studying it for yourself. If you need help with a certain topic or passage, you could send it my way and I could have a conversation with you. We could explore together. But my challenge to you is to find something in the Old Testament that always intrigued you, confused you, offended you, whatever it might be, and study the context around it. Study why it's there, what God is trying to convey, and how it leads us into a greater experience in the story of Jesus. So in response, I want us to close our eyes. I want to read this thing that I found. You might be thinking, hey, it's really cool that, you know, the Old Testament leads us into an encounter with Jesus, that the Old Testament is really about Jesus, that everything points to Jesus. That's cool, but I don't know if I really see it. Like, there are certain parts of the Old Testament, like, how does that connect to Jesus? How does that relate to my life? And so I just want to read this thing that I found. It's about Jesus and how he's found all throughout the Old Testament, that all of the Old Testament points to the person of Jesus. Jesus is the true and better Adam who passed the test in the garden and whose obedience is assigned to us. Jesus is the true and better Abel, who though innocently slain, has blood that now cries out for our freedom, not our condemnation. Jesus is the true and better Abraham, who answered the call of God to leave all the comfortable and familiar and go out into the void to create a new people of God. Jesus is the true and better Isaac, who was not just offered up by his father, but was truly sacrificed for us. While God said to Abraham, "Now I know you love me because you did not withhold your son, your only son whom you love from me. Now we can say to God, now we know that you love me because you did not withhold your son, your only son whom you love from me." Jesus is the true and better Jacob who wrestled and took the blow of justice we deserved. Jesus is the true and better Joseph who at the right hand of the king forgives those who betrayed and sold him and uses his new power to save them. Jesus is the true and better Moses who stands in the gap between the people and the Lord and who mediates a new covenant. Jesus is the true and better rock of Moses, who struck with the rod of God's justice, now gives us water in the desert. Jesus is the true and better Job, the truly innocent sufferer, who then intercedes for and saves his stupid friends. Jesus is the true and better David, whose victory becomes his people's victory, though they never lifted a stone to accomplish it themselves. Jesus is the true and better Esther, who didn't just risk losing an earthly palace, but lost the ultimate and heavenly one, who didn't just risk his life, but gave his life to save his people. God, our prayer this morning, let us be a people who immerse ourselves in the full story of the Bible, who learn to turn these 2D words into a 3D encounter with you. who know how to play our part in the story well by knowing so well what's come before, by understanding what it's all led toward. God, would you make us a people that love your word, not just the parts that tickle us or make us feel good, but even the parts that challenge us, even the parts that offend us, even the parts that confuse us. And would you give us new eyes to see the Old Testament, not as a rule book to follow, but as a story that reveals a God who is trying to move humanity back to Eden, back toward the ideal. And even in our day and age, that's exactly what you're doing. You're both accommodating to us in our culture and moving us forward in our culture. And I pray that as we look to this ancient text, as we look contextually at our day and age, that we would continue moving toward Eden, making this world a place where we can love you and love others freely. We love you and we thank you for your presence.
Thank you for listening. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope this teaching encourages you. To learn more about 99, visit our website at 99.church. Until next time, grace and peace.